Confronting Racial Injustice. Night after night, protesters have taken to the streets of cities and towns all over America to express outrage over the deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, and to call for systemic change in the criminal justice system. In Maine, we've seen protests in several communities, including Bangor, Brunswick, Rockland, Farmington, and for several nights in a row in Portland. Some of it has led to destructive activities and arrest. Last night in Portland, the city manager, police chief, and other officers knelt in solidarity with the protesters. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, what next? What is the racial climate in Maine, and what's happening to improve it? How does this country move forward with meaningful change toward greater racial justice? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. The death of George Floyd has triggered an outpouring of outrage and protests nationwide and here in Maine. Today, we'll talk about racial justice and the role of law enforcement, how Maine addresses these difficult issues, and whether there is hope for progress. Joining me right now, the Reverend Kenneth Lewis. He is senior pastor of Green Memorial AME Zion Church and also executive director of Maine Health Center for Tobacco Independence. And Frank Clark is with us, the chief of the Portland Police Department. As always, we want to hear from you. What do you feel needs to be done to address racial inequity? What purpose do you think the protests serve? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. Thank you both so much for being here, Chief Clark. I understand we only have you for part of the hour, but we appreciate, given everything you're doing right now, that you can be here at all. Reverend Lewis, we are experiencing national outrage over the death of George Floyd, but this is really about all the Black Americans who have died unjustly over the years. You've seen this before. Is there anything different this time?
Well, I think the challenge is that I've seen this before. This is not a new phenomenon. This is something that has taken place over decades, over centuries. The challenge is that it doesn't seem to stop. From one generation to the next, we tend to see this the death and destruction of a Black man, unfortunately, across our country, the pain, the hurt, the disenfranchisement, the disparity, it seems to continue. And I think that across the country, in our space, the fight continues on, but you wonder at times whether or not you're making any progress.
Chief Clark, last night, you, as well as the city manager of Portland and other officers, knelt with protesters, and then this morning took part in a news conference with several other law enforcement leaders. What is your message to the protesters and everyone in Maine who is so upset?
I think our general message, and my general message, I think, since having watched that video, and I'll have to say my first reaction in watching that video was just a disbelief that was happening in front of my eyes. And it was something that I certainly looked at. I don't know how many times the first time through, I kept just saying, get off his neck, get off his neck, because that is not anything that our police officers are trained to do. It's not a technique or a tactic that's approved here in the Portland Police Department or anywhere else in the state of Maine, to my knowledge. And it's something that I can certainly understand. When I actually saw that, I said, as many miles as geographically distant as the city of Minneapolis is from the city of Portland in the state of Maine, I certainly recognized immediately that those officers' actions and the other officers' inactions were going to reverberate through our country, including here in our state and and in our city. And I, you know, we're certainly seeing that. And I think what I want to express is the fact that we hear you. We hear what people are. We understand that people are angry. We understand that there's pain. We understand that there's hurt. We understand that there's fear. And that's because we hold a public trust. And really at this point, and particularly after the last couple of nights, one of my messages that I certainly want to get out there is we just can't let that anger, let those emotions turn into violence. And I'm certainly just want to send a message that, you know, we fully and wholeheartedly support the peaceful protesters that are coming here to the city of Portland. We want to protect them in that group. And that's what our intent is going forward, is really to listen and to be a part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, and
go ahead, Reverend Lewis.
I think one of the things, so one of the reports that I saw was this particular officer had 17 use of force complaints. So, I began to question what some of the disciplinary processes have occurred across the country, and where there are different degrees of citizens review and oversight. 17 use of force complaints. And is there something systemic wrong here in the level of oversight, the level of training, the level of expectation? 17 use of force complaints.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that we have to look at. When power is abused and misused, it causes damage to communities, to individuals. In this instance, it caused the loss of a life.
Let me turn this to you, Chief Clark. You can't speak for the Minneapolis Police Department, I know, but if someone has, are there people on the Portland Police Department roster who have 17 complaints against them?
No, I shouldn't say that as definitively as I just did, but I, from having been here less than a year, about 9 months at this point, I haven't gone through or seen all of those records, but from the nature of the complaints that I've seen that have come in to date, again, in the last 9 months, I'm trying to think if we've had potentially one such similar type of complaint. And actually, that was been a very rewarding or comforting thing that I have received in the last several days. I was up on Congress Street the other night during one of the protests, and many people have come up during this. Again, the people that are there to express their views and to be peaceable, and have said, this isn't about the Portland Police Department. This isn't, you know, about the Westwood Police Department or any particular police department in the state of Maine. And I think, as the Reverend just made reference to, their concern and their ask and what they want us to hear is that this is a systemic type of an issue, and that we need to have this conversation more broadly. So, I can just speak very quickly on, you know, we as a profession and specifically as a department, we have very high standards in terms of hiring to call out people, to assess character, to, you know, we have psychological standards, educational standards, polygraph examinations, thorough backgrounds. I'm sure we're not 100% in that regard, which is why we have, you know, supervisory protocols in place, accountability, but only about 5-6% of the people that apply to be a Portland police officer actually attain that goal. And again, I think that speaks highly to the standards that we have here in this area.
Chief, what changes? You know, we're hearing this expression a lot, systemic change. Some people calling for defunding police departments altogether. What do you believe is the systemic change that needs to happen? And what can happen in your own police department that might address concerns?
Well, what we're doing, what we really do on an ongoing basis, but what we're certainly doing in the wake of this tragedy is focusing in on what policies, what practices we have here in the department that would relate to this type of an issue, and essentially, I'd like to use the word ensure that it does not and would not happen here. And one of the things that was one of my other reactions when I watched the video initially was, again, having been in law enforcement here in Maine for 31 years, in a couple of different departments and knowing, you know, hundreds of police officers, I watched the video, and again, I hate to be so definitive, but my little reaction was that would not happen here. You know, whether it was the officer that was taking the action that would have made a decision once George Floyd was making the statements that he was, or whether it was the other officers who were standing behind him who would have taken an action in order to see what was going on at that point. I truly believe that would happen here in the state. So I think it's having those conversations. It's looking at the training. It's looking at the policies. And it's, quite frankly, it comes down, I think, to communication, because the more communication that we have, the more dialogue that we have, the more mutual respect and understanding I think we will all have. So I think it's going to kind of boil down to communication and making sure that we build and maintain those relationships with all of our community members, because if we don't have the trust of our community, we are ineffective and not doing our job as a police department.
Reverend Lewis, I want to ask you, I want to have this conversation be much broader than it is, but because we only have a certain amount of time with the chief, we are talking about law enforcement at this point. Ken Lewis, what do you hear from your community? Is what you hear about the interaction with law enforcement officers in southern Maine and Maine in general better than it is in the rest of the country?
I can't say whether it's better or it's worse. I've lived here for 17 years, and so I've not had the opportunity to experience policing in other places over the last 17 years. But I will say this. Young men have significant challenges and fears associated with engaging police. Young black men, brown men, and that is systemic. That is from what they've seen on television. It's the rules that my father taught me when I was young, growing up in Boston. And so my personal engagement with the Portland Police Department, I have a really good relationship with them. I serve on the police citizens a review subcommittee. I see all the internal affairs investigations. I believe that community policing at its best requires relationships. Relationships that are developed over a period of time, especially with our younger population. And so there's this insidious set of information that we see on a regular basis. And, you know, I am George Floyd, and everyone will say that. That could have been me. And regardless of whether you're in Portland, Westbrook, Boston, New York, Chicago, it's blue. And that's the reality. And the requirement, I believe, is for police departments and cities and organizations to be intentional in their engagement, to engage the community at the community level in order to develop the kind of relationship that's going to be positive over time. And I think that's the way to build the trust over a long period of time.
I'm going to go to Jennifer on Facebook. She writes, "I am a Portland native. Our city is just too tiny for a police department to be using such military tactics as tear gas and large vehicles. It's truly terrifying. I understand people do not want looting. However, people also don't want to be killed by racism. What can be done so that people can protest and be safe?" Chief.
Yeah, and that's exactly the line that we're trying to draw, is we want to support the peaceful protesters. And what our ask has been, and I just had a press conference a short time ago at City Hall, and one of the questions that was asked was, you know, what do you tell the peaceful protesters, what do you tell them to do? I mean, last night's protest is a perfect example. They came here. They had very positive comments, discussions. There was a lot of some good communication, I thought. They were talking about a lot of the same things that I think are key to all of us, you know, love, peace, democracy, trust, education, respect. Those are all kind of values and concepts that they talked about. So it was all very positive. And they marched. We had a lead car. We had a tail car. We blocked intersections. We allowed them to march up from the east end and then back down to the west end and supported their efforts to exercise their First Amendment rights. At the end of that, the organizers said, we're done. You know, thank you. Again, a lot of good conversation, and then they try to send people home. And so what we saw actually come back to the police station last night, and it happened the night before, was a smaller subset of folks that we believe are here specifically to agitate, and that they're actually causing fights within the broader group itself, which is concerning. So we have not, during the course of this, deployed tear gas. We have deployed some OC, which is oleoresin capsicum foggers, in order to keep people back. Our officers have been, unfortunately, again, by the violent minority, I will say, been pelted with rocks and bricks and bottles and whatnot, and it's during those interactions and in response to those sorts of efforts that our officers are trying to, again, to protect themselves and to not let things get out of control, that they're using those levels of force in order to try to, you know, quell that disturbance and hopefully disperse what has become, what has turned from a lawful protest into an unruly crowd. And I think that's what when it goes from being something that's lawful and constitutionally protected to criminal in nature, where our officers and the public are potentially at risk, and certainly the property in the city is at risk, is when we try to draw that line.
Joining us now, Desiree Vargas, who is co-founder of Racial Equity and Justice based in Bangor. She's a community organizer and advocate. Desiree, were you at the Portland protest last night?
I was not.
Okay, so I won't ask you specifically about what Chief Clark has just said, but tell us about the organization you helped to start, and what are you hoping to achieve?
Yeah, so Racial Equity and Justice was co-founded by David Patrick and I, and our main goals is to not only empower Black, Brown, and Indigenous people of color in Maine, but also we really just saw a need. Maine is made up, the demographic is, you know, almost 95% white people. And so we have grown up here and we realize, you know, there needs to be a lot of education and not just, you know, social media education or anything. Like, we wanted, like, really on the ground education. So we decided to do certified trainings and go into professional, academic, in other workspaces to do some racial and bias and diversity trainings. We feel like that's really important. And we do a lot of other resource distribution to marginalized communities, not even just Black, Brown, Indigenous people of color communities, but also we try to work with LGBTQIA advocates, as well as working on people who are economically disadvantaged. And right now during COVID, you know, on top of a lot of the work we're doing for racial issues, we're working hand in hand with sister organizations like the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine. I'm actually a program director there. And we're working on food pantries during COVID and community food gardens and grants, and really trying to get addressing food insecurity, which is an issue in Maine as well.
Desiree, I'm going to ask if you can stay on the line with us for a little bit longer. Chief Clark won't be able to be with us much longer, and there's some questions coming in for him. Chief Clark, here's one from Jason on Facebook. We will just repeat the same conversations and hear the same platitudes we have been subjected to for the last 60 years. There has been no change in my lifetime. There has been hours of talk from leadership and promises to change and make it all better, but in the end, nothing happens. Maybe your discussion should be about why things do not change, why there are still racists on police force, and why people of color keep dying at the hands of police forces and nothing is done to change this.
I would make a reference to something that Reverend Lewis said a couple minutes ago, which was we had a conversation with some of the organizers yesterday, and one of the young male youths of color made reference to that fact that the Reverend just brought up, which was he feels scared about when he goes out, when he sees a police car behind him, or when he sees a police officer. And I think that's at the core. It's those relationships that the Reverend made reference to that we really need to focus on and in a mutual way as well, because we need to break down those barriers. I was just getting an email about half an hour before this phone call from a friend of mine whose grandson is a he's a black man, and he has a grandson that's a youth, and he goes, I'd really like to bring him into the police station because I want him now to know that police officers are there to help. So to kind of like break away from, again, the relationships and the trust that I think is very key, and I agree with the Reverend on that, to moving forward. We do, as an agency, I'm proud of Maine law enforcement in particular. It's what I know in terms of the standards that we set at the state level when it comes to setting specific policy, minimum mandatory policy standards statewide. So there's some consistency in how we apply force in our bias-based policing, our profiling policies. I mean, there are certain things that need to be in place here in the state in order to try to impact the specific concerns that that he raised. So I think things are being done, but we just need to continue along that path. And I think it's having those partnerships. I couldn't agree more with the Reverend, having those partnerships and having that mutual trust that is going to go a long ways in seeing some.
Jennifer, I would like to just add to that, and I know you're probably up on a break, but Frederick Douglass says power concedes nothing without a demand. It concedes absolutely nothing without a demand, and if there is no struggle, there is no progress. And so the deprecation of agitation is something that we can't stand for. There are times in which there needs to be agitation in order to get action. And I think at the core of the protest is to agitate the status quo so that the status quo is no more. And that means someone is going to have to be uncomfortable in their privileged place. And I think that's what our protesters are saying, that's what they're espousing, and that's what they're looking for. They're looking to agitate the system enough to change it or to replace it.
Reverend Kenneth Lewis,
yeah. Work equitably.
Yeah. The Reverend Kenneth Lewis also. Thank you so much. Chief Frank Clark of the Portland Police Department will be returning to this topic, I'm sure, on Maine Calling, and we invite you to come back. We do need to go to a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
From Lamy Wellahan Shoes, helping people in Maine communities through their shoe donation program, gathering and distributing over 10,000 pairs of shoes to Mainers in need. Evergreen Home Performance, sending its heartfelt thanks to Maine's healthcare workers, first responders, elder care workers, and all the everyday heroes helping Maine people. And Tussin University, committed to strengthening Maine's future by preparing the business, health, and communication professionals of tomorrow. Husson.edu.
Civil protest is part of the DNA of Atlanta. And the city where Martin Luther King Jr. preached, what does the pulpit sound like today?
To be silent while this is happening is not only to be on the wrong side of history, I submit that it is to be on the wrong side of God.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the civil rights fight then and now, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. You count on reliable news, the truth, a trusted source for your information, and that's why you're listening to Maine Public Radio, and why you also might appreciate Maine Public Television. Each evening between 5 and 6, there is a full hour of BBC News with a global perspective on the top news of the day. Following that at 6, there is the PBS NewsHour, which is also available at 7 o'clock each evening. A full hour in-depth analysis of the day's events and issues. The Maine Public Television early evening news block schedule can be seen at mainepublic.org. Please click on the television drop-down to see it.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, talking about the social unrest over racism and law enforcement nationwide and here in Maine. My guest, Portland Police Chief Frank Clark had to go, but we're also here with senior pastor at Green Memorial AME Zion Church, Reverend Kenneth Lewis, on the line with us as well right now, Desiree Vargas, co-founder of Racial Equity and Justice based in Bangor. Desiree, thanks for staying with us for just a few more minutes. And I wanted to ask about the protest you organized in Bangor. I understand a very large turnout. What is it that you hoped to do? What do you hope is the effect of the protest in Bangor?
Great question. Yeah, definitely social awareness for protests is only a small portion of what needs to be done. We really, our efforts go beyond the rally. And so we have been coming up with a proposal and working very close with the Bangor City officials on the council, as well as actually the police department as well, and NAACP, some other organizations. We have come up with a proposal, and we really, what we want to see are really simple things. We want to have an advisory committee, a diversity advisory board, really, to guide policy made up. And we want that that advisory board to be made up of people of color, just to be able to really be on the decision-making table with city officials. And we want racial and bias training, so professional staff and city council, as well as supporting brown, black, indigenous organizations, businesses, and own communities. We want people to be able to start really looking to be doing those things. I know a lot of people are like, they have all this energy and they don't know where to put it. They want to help. And it's really just support those organizations on the ground that are organizations led and worked on by people of color. Those are our proposals.
Desiree, thanks so much for joining us today for part of Maine Calling. That's Desiree Vargas, who is co-founder of Racial Equity and Justice, which is based in Bangor. She's a community organizer there. Reverend Lewis, I've seen on my social media feeds a lot of people talking about systemic change, yes, but also talking about what have you done today? People saying, I ordered 5 books by Black authors. That's what I did today. People putting out lists of businesses, restaurants owned by people of color. What is your response, your reaction to people for whom that is what they are doing right now in this moment?
Well, I think that sometimes that makes them feel good about themselves. You know, I think that this is such a deep-seated, insidious situation with structural and institutional racism. You know, I believe that, you know, you try to change people one person at a time, and there's some passivity to just posting about something. And I don't want to diminish the fact that people go out on a limb by making those types of statements about books. I think educating each other is important. I think supporting businesses is important. But I also believe that infiltrating the systems and being part of the powerful places is important as well. And so I think that's nice, but it's just nice. I don't know if that changes a whole lot because the structures still exist. For those who are allies, you can be an ally today and tomorrow just go back to a place of privilege. I can't do that. I'm the same person today and tomorrow. I'm the Black man who is scared or representing the Black young people who are scared and don't necessarily know how to navigate these structures, these institutions that are deeply rooted in a racist construct.
On the line with us now, Shenna Bellows, who is a state senator for District 14, also executive director of the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Thanks for calling in, Shenna.
Thank you so much. This is such a great conversation, and Reverend Lewis is exactly right. Part of white privilege is that ability to walk away, to read a book, and then close that. And so one of the questions we ask at the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine is, how are white people using our privilege to break down institutional racism and institute structural change? I'll give you one example. This year, Maine celebrates its bicentennial, but most of our celebrations are dominated or almost exclusively lifting up white people. So we convened a Vision 2020 steering committee of exclusively people of color, to look at that and to do a public call for action to Mainers to start thinking about who are Maine's Black and Brown heroes. Other examples, in your nonprofit or businesses, are you recruiting people of color to serve on your boards, to work in your workplaces? Are you paying people adequately? Or are you expecting them to do this anti-bias or anti-racism work for you or for your organization for free? I think these are some of the questions that we're trying to ask. Yesterday, we held a statewide anti-bias workshop for students and teachers all across the state. We had 196 students and teachers show up for that. And that's part of that first step of breaking down and challenging our own privilege.
All right. Well, Shanna, thanks so much for calling in. And we will post information about the initiative you mentioned and the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, both on our Facebook page and web page for those, like I like to say, who don't listen to the radio with a pen, but are more interested in learning more about that initiative. Shanna Bellows leads the Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine. Lucy on Facebook writes, I think we white people all grew up surrounded by racist messages, perhaps not blatantly so, but nonetheless there. We have to acknowledge these biases, talk about them, and act to change. Your program is a good start. I think, Reverend Lewis, one of the questions you talk about power, how does one use, every individual has power, how does one that use that power to act?
Well, I don't think every individual has power. I think, you know, unfortunately, everyone doesn't have a voice that will be heard. Everyone does not have the same access, whether it's access to health care, access to economic opportunity, access to educational opportunity. But I think the inherent power is to engage individually with people. To not think you know me, but get to know me, if you will, and to be intentional about engaging one another, not to seek to supersede or to step out in front from a privileged place, talking about my white brothers and sisters, but to learn about me and not to expect that I'm going to be your primary teacher all the time, right? And so using the power of the, if you look at the Black Lives Matter website, they talk about, the official website, they talk about what matters in 2020. And it's about engaging an underrepresented community in the electoral process. So how do we exercise our power? We exercise our power by voting. How do we exercise our power? By promoting candidates who represent our interests. How do we exercise our power? By challenging and charging those people in political positions to listen to us, and when they don't listen, we vote them out. I think those are the types of things that have to be engaged. It's the young working with the older in a very focused way, in order to identify and then identify the issues, challenge the status quo, and come with a solution that's going to bring about lasting change.
We'll go to Frederick, who's calling from Bath. Hi, Frederick. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah. Hi, Jennifer and Reverend. I find it difficult to follow up your wonderful analysis, Reverend, about being active and engaged. And until I think we do that structural deep change, we privileged white people need to stand for those that don't have the voice, that don't have the finances. I think of Reverend William Barber and his Poor People's Movement this summer. This organization is, well, organizing people all throughout Appalachia, white and black, all throughout the Southwest to be involved. That's an organization that we privileged whites in Maine can get behind, send them a check, find out about the Poor People's Campaign, just as an example. And let's listen also, lastly, to Joe Biden, who said recently we're talking about 400 years. Now, to me, Joe Biden has a deep feeling and soul about what has happened with African-Americans and Native Americans. And Reverend, I look forward to your response to those thoughts. Thanks.
Well, I'm not going to make a political statement today, but I think that, you know, I'm Native and I'm African-American. I've seen and heard and witnessed the disparities that my people have encountered. We need strong allies, business allies, political allies to help create a beloved community, which is what we all desire, and a more perfect union. And that's going to take a lot of work. The Poor People's Campaign was in Portland, I think, last summer. Tremendous gathering. But we got to follow up. You know, I think we're really good at having a great gathering. We throw a really good party collectively, and we pat ourselves on the back. But then we go back to places of privilege, and we don't see any change. And we kind of feel good that we did something. This work requires consistency and a level of perseverance, and you got to be sold out to it. I know people who work in this space, and they never get an opportunity to unplug and turn off, because the mere fact that they work in the space of racial justice, they're always dealing with it, whether it's work or personally, professionally, or what have you. And it's work that has to happen, and it requires a tremendous amount of energy to make any type of progress. Because, again, I will say, as Frederick Douglass said, power doesn't concede anything without a demand. And if there's no forum whereby my demand can be heard, then the power is not going to relent.
Frederick, thank you for calling in. We do need to take another quick break. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling. With help from Simply Sized Home, downsizing and moving management specialists serving Southern and Midcoast Maine. Learn more at simplysizedhome.com. New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And Maine Energy Systems, offering wood pellet central heating with a goal of positively impacting the environment. MaineEnergySystems.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Settled in 1762, the town of Tremont was incorporated on June 3, 1848 as Mansell, the name given the island by John Winthrop's company of emigrants to the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630. The town was renamed Tremont 2 months later at the request of the townspeople by a legislative act on August 8, 1848. The name Tremont, which means three mountains in French, is thought to be derived from the three mountain peaks in the Western Mountain Chain, Barnard, Mansell, and Western.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Bernstein Schur and Maine Masons, celebrating their bicentennial in Maine. Happy birthday, Maine! The Daily Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus will take place at about 2 o'clock this afternoon. Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page will all bring it to you live. In addition, each day's address is archived at MainePublic.org. For later on-demand viewing or listening, just choose the television drop-down. Again, Maine's CDC briefing with Dr. Shaw and others is scheduled for 2 o'clock this afternoon and carried here on Maine Public Radio, as well as Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and the Maine Public Facebook page.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We're talking about how issues of racial injustice have come to a head and what can be done. Joining me, Reverend Ken Lewis, Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is Shay Stewart-Booley. She is a writer and speaker who is also known as Black Girl in Maine. She's executive director also of Community Change Incorporated in Boston. And today she's calling in from Chicago. Thanks for calling in, Shay.
Great. Thank you for having me. Really wonderful conversation. And just wanted to say that Reverend Lewis is saying a lot, so I appreciate what's already been said in this conversation.
You have spent many years calling attention to racial discrimination in Maine. What is your reaction now to the national uprising and to what you're seeing in cities in Maine, the protests?
You know what? It's really not unexpected. I feel like, you know, Reverend Lewis just said something that really resonated with me, that too many times people kind of come out, they use their privilege, and then we kind of go back. If you look back over the past 6 years since 2014, you know, it's almost like clockwork. We're having these conversations, and yet nothing has changed. In this current moment, it was just mentioned in the introduction, I'm in Chicago. And so, you know, I'm actually in the middle of the city where I've been seeing nonstop protests, some of the looting and some of the other things that are happening. I've been paying attention and following online the protests that are happening in Maine. And one of the things is there's a through line, whether you are in a major city, whether you are in Maine, is that racism is real. One of the things that I think that I've been listening to this conversation and other conversations, one of the things that concerns me when we talk about this moment is the language that we're using. Language matters. One of the things that I'm noticing, there's a lot of this tendency to refer to people of color, minorities, people of color, when in fact we need to actually name that a lot of this violence that we are seeing is aimed at Black people, whether it's, you know, from the police and other pieces of that, and understanding that, you know, this country itself for over 400 years has struggled with racism. It is the original sin. We try not to talk about it. Instead, we slap Band-Aids on it. And of course, what happens when you slap a Band-Aid on a, you know, a bullet wound, you're never going to get to solving the problem. So, you know, it makes sense that we are in this moment. It's a perfect storm. You have a coronavirus, which we know has disproportionately affected Black people around the country. Even in Maine, we look at the numbers and disproportionately Black people are being affected. The economy, you know, is in shambles. Who's being disproportionately affected? Leadership at the highest levels of this country, I'm just going to name it. It's racist. You know, we hear language that's coded, not so coded, dog whistles. So it would make sense that we would be at this moment. It is very, very unlike, I mean, very much like what happened in the 1960s. And yet, in some ways, it's even more explosive.
Yeah, so Shay, let me ask you, what would you say directly to those people who, you know, the young people, the white people who are taking part in these protests? What would you like to see them do afterwards? They're clearly outraged today. They clearly want change. What do you want them to do tomorrow and next week and next month?
What I want them to do is to be intentional and being anti-racist all the time and to actually look at the systems and structures around them. I believe that Shenna Bellows made note of that in her comments. I often, when I talk with people, tell them, you know, when you go back to your community, it's great that you love hearing me or other anti-racist speakers talk or write, but what are you doing in your own community? Are you looking at, you know, who's making the decisions? Who's in your community? Who's being represented? Whose voice is not being heard? And how can you make that change there? In a place like Maine, we have a lot of opportunities to do that work. Again, I look at things like school boards. I look at, you know, the policing. Those are the places where you really make the change. Reverend Lewis alluded to, and I can't remember the complete context, you know, people saying they're reading books. Books are absolutely great. Going online and expressing your views are great, but that's not how we're going to make systemic change. We actually have to be committed to that change, and that change starts within our own circles and spreads out from there.
Yeah, I'd like to add, if I could.
Yes.
And Shay, good to hear your voice. Are you willing to be uncomfortable and unpopular in your traditionally comfortable in popular places. How committed is the ally to that? To clap back their family members, their coworkers, the people they grew up with, to stand for anti-racist regimes, language, conversations. How committed are you to risk the popularity and the comfort? It's easy to get lost in a crowd. It takes quite a bit to stand up by yourself when there are others around you who do not hold the same ideals or desires for outcomes.
That is so true. I would absolutely agree with you, Reverend, that for white people, to kind of get back to your question there, for white folks wanting to know what they need to do, you need to get very comfortable being uncomfortable. If you are serious and you are committed to racial justice, you can fully expect that as a white person, you're going to lose some friends. You may lose some family members, and you need to be willing to lean into that. One of the problems that I see it is that too many times it's easy for white people to check in and out of this work. That they can be on the streets right now, but are you going to actually, you know, talk to Uncle Rusty the racist at Thanksgiving? Are you going to call out your own mother and father if need be? Are you willing to lose your job? As I tell people often, what are you, like, what skin are you putting in the game? Because like Reverend Lewis said earlier, I, you know, for myself as a 47-year-old black woman, I'm black every day of my life. I don't get a chance to take a break from this. Even now, I'm here in Chicago with my dad in hospice dying, and yet I need to be aware of just the fact I'm still a black woman in the middle of all of this going on. I need white people to get to that point where their understanding of racism is so fine-tuned that it never leaves them. I think when we get to that point, that's when we're going to see the change. Until then, we are putting a disproportionate burden on black people and other people of color to solve a problem that is not actually ours to solve. It's a white problem. White people need to solve the problem. White people are the major beneficiary of racism. What exactly are you doing to help solve the problem?
Shay, thank you so much for calling in, especially when you're going through such a difficult time personally. That's Shay Stewart Booley, black girl in Maine, an advocate for greater racial equality, calling in today from Chicago. We're going to go to Holly, who's calling from Emden. Hi, Holly, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call and for addressing this topic. I just wanted to share the perspective of being a white woman in Maine who is married to a black man. And we have had, over the past two decades, we've each had three interactions with law enforcement. Nothing major, you know, just pulled over on the turnpike for, you know, speeding and things like that. But the outcomes of those six interactions were very different. In my husband's case, he was detained for a long time each time. One police officer in Norridgewalk told him, you're lucky I didn't arrest you on the spot. You know, he was heavily ticketed, whereas I was let go. And by the way, we have very similar driving patterns. But I was let go in 5 minutes. I was given warnings, have a nice day, be safe. And I was done. So, you know, this is just anecdotal, but it builds and it happened over and over again. In fact, one time I was the one driving and speeding and we were pulled over, and yet it was my husband, and this was in Wells, that they made a big deal about. They wanted his ID. They kept asking him, where are you from? Where are you from? What are you doing in Wells? And we had two sleeping babies in the back, you know, so I understand we haven't had any major violent episodes yet in Maine, but I think we still have a lot of work to do.
Holly, thank you so much. Yeah, for calling it and sharing your perspective as somebody who's part of an interracial couple. And I'm sure as you're hearing this, Reverend Lewis, you're not surprised at all.
I'm not surprised at all. You know, I'm privileged to serve as the pastor of the Green Memorial African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church. A lot of interracial couples here. I have couples who have adopted black children and things of that sort. And so we have those kinds of conversations. My wife and I, not long ago, were in Long Island. I was doing a wedding for a young man I met when he was a kid. Stopped on the road. I guess the rental car, the full lights weren't on, and it was after dusk. The police had red lights. Red lights to me meant fire truck, ambulance. I pulled over and to let the ambulance by, and lo and behold, it was a police officer. I double-checked the lights. The lights were all working. I turned them back on. But I was given a summons to appear in Long Island. I live in Portland. But I had the privilege of being able to get an attorney to deal with it, right? And so what happens when you don't know your rights, you don't have access to advocacy? You know, it's a scary thing. It was a dark place. And the officer was not kind. And he carries a gun. So, you know, that's never a comfortable place, and it's definitely not a comfortable place for me.
Right.
And so it happens all the time. Profiling happens all the time across our country until those persons with the power to root it out and rid it out exercise that power. It's going to continue to happen.
Reverend Lewis, we just have a few seconds. Big question for a few seconds to give you an answer. Would we be seeing what we're seeing today if it were not for cell phone video?
No. You know, so these types of things have happened for years. You know, no one saw a video of Emmett Till. No one saw a video of strange fruit hanging from poplar trees, lynchings across the country. You know, that those messages had to be amplified. Well, now we get it live and in color. And, you know, I think that that's an important aspect. This is where our society has moved to. There's an immediate reaction to the things that we see. And the borders don't make a difference. The bridge doesn't separate us from the things that happen south of Maine.
Thank you so much for being here today. That's Reverend Kenneth Lewis of the Green Memorial AME Zion Church in Portland. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. In just a few minutes, CDC Director Dr. Nirav Shah will give his daily briefing on radio, television, and online. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.